This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we're going to listen to an interview Terry recorded with Yah Jesse, author of one of the most anticipated novels of the fall season. I'll let Terry introduce it.
Yah Jesse's first novel, Homegoing, published in 2016, was about the legacy of slavery in several generations of the families of two half-sisters born in Ghana in the 1700s. The novel had the reception first writers dream of. It won a National Book Critics Circle Award, a Penn Hemingway Award, and the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 honors. Jesse's new novel, her second, is called Transcendent Kingdom. The novel draws on Jesse's life as the daughter of immigrants from Ghana. Jesse was born in Ghana and came to the U.S. with her parents in 1991 when she was 2. In the novel, the main character, Gifty, is a scientist studying the neurocircuitry of reward-seeking behavior in mice. Maybe it will help her understand how her brother got addicted to OxyContin, then heroin, and died of an overdose. Gifty, like Jesse, was raised in Alabama, and for reasons we'll get into soon, her family attended a white Pentecostal church. Gifty was a believer as a child, stopped going to church after her brother's death, but still has a thirst for redemption and the transcendent. Neither religion nor science are satisfying her need to make things clear, to make meaning. After Gifty's brother died, she says she went quiet and her mother went insane, spending most of her time in bed. Gifty's mother refuses any form of therapy because she doesn't believe in depression or mental illness. Throughout Gifty's life, she tries to understand how she is perceived by white people and black people in America as the daughter of Ghanaian parents. In the Washington Post's review of Transcendent Kingdom, Ron Charles describes it as, quote, a novel of profound scientific and spiritual reflection. Indeed, Jesse's ability to interrogate medical and religious issues in the context of America's fraught racial environment makes her one of the most enlightening novelists writing today, unquote. Yah Jesse, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on the book. It's really wonderful. So this feels like a very personal book dealing with a lot of pain and confusion. Your first novel had a lot of pain, but that was very historical, and this one feels very personal. Is it?
It is in some ways. I was writing about the places that I knew best, particularly Huntsville, Alabama, the place that I grew up in. And I was also writing about religion, which was a big part of my life and my childhood. Like the character Gifty in this novel, I grew up Pentecostal and left the church, though under very different circumstances than she leaves it. So it was an opportunity for me to revisit that time in my life.
So you mentioned the church. I want you to read a passage from the novel about the family becoming part of the white Pentecostal church in Alabama. And this section happens when Gifty is trying to understand her brother's addiction, her mother's depression, and her own guilt and self-hatred. When she was a child, she says she never heard the expression institutional racism, wasn't discussed in school. She didn't grow up with a language for a way to explain her self-loathing, and everything around her seemed to confirm the idea that she was irreparably wrong. But she was a child who liked to be right. So let's get to this reading, which follows those thoughts.
We were the only black people at the First Assemblies of God Church. My mother didn't know any better. She thought the God of America must be the same as the God of Ghana, that the Jehovah of the white church could not possibly be different from the one of the black church. That day, when she saw the marquee outside asking, "Do you feel lost?" That day, when she first walked into the sanctuary, she began to lose her children, who would learn well before she did that not all churches in America are created equal, not in practice and not in politics. And for me, the damage of going to a church where people whispered disparaging words about my kind was itself a spiritual wound, so deep and so hidden that it has taken me years to find and address it. I didn't know what to make of the world that I was in back then. I didn't know how to reconcile it. When my mother and I made prayer requests for Nana, did the congregation really pray? Did they really care? When I heard the gossip of those two women, I saw the veil lift and the shadow world of my religion came into view. Where was God in all of this? Where was God if he was not in the hushed quiet of a Sunday school room? Where was God if he was not in me? If my blackness was a kind of indictment, if Nana would never be healed, and if my congregation could never truly believe in the possibility of his healing, then where was God?
And I should mention that Nana is Gifty's brother, the one who becomes addicted to OxyContin after a basketball injury, and then that leads to a heroin addiction. So how did your family end up joining a white Pentecostal church?
I think it was mostly really a matter of convenience because my family lived on the southeast side of Huntsville, which is the predominantly white side, and we had always grown up going to Pentecostal churches, and so they picked one that was nearby. And I don't think there was really much consideration into the fact that religious practices are different across racial lines here in America. I think they were so accustomed to churches and cities, for that matter, that were more mixed that they didn't really think about it. So we ended up at a predominantly white Pentecostal church.
Have you often thought about how your life and your mother's life might have been different had it been a predominantly black Pentecostal church?
I do think about that a lot, and I think that's part of the reason why I wanted to explore these themes in the book. Just then, when I read the sentence about how churches in America are not created equal in practice or in politics, I think that's something that I had to come to learn on my own when I was a little older. Now, I guess I'm thinking about the fact that sometimes we talk about the religious right, which to me was very much the kind of church that I grew up in, conservative, politically conservative, but also kind of micro-aggressively racist. And I think had I gone to a church where people looked like me, that aspect of things would have fallen away, and maybe my belief would have lasted.
Your family moved to Alabama when your father got a tenure-track position at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct.
How old were you when you moved to Alabama? Because you'd lived in Tennessee and, I think, Ohio before that.
Yeah, we had lived in Ohio, Illinois, and Tennessee before we got to Alabama. We moved to Alabama when I was 9.
So what was it like to be in a state that had such a history of racism and segregation?
It was jarring for a lot of reasons. I don't know if the first reason that it was jarring was because of the legacy of racism and segregation. I don't think I was old enough really to really grapple with that when we first moved there. I think at that point, I was mostly just very tired of moving and wanted to stay in one place, even if that place was Alabama. When we got there, it was the first place where we lived in a predominantly white neighborhood, and my parents chose that area because of the schools, because they had read and talked to other people about how the schools were better on the south side of Huntsville. So that was a change. And then I think the other major change is that in every other place that we had lived, there was a decent-sized West African immigrant community. In Ohio, there were many Ghanaians, and in other places, there were Ghanaians and Nigerians, and my family was able to kind of keep community at the forefront. But when we got to Huntsville, there was like one other family in Meridianville that was Ghanaian, and that was it. So that, I think, was the other major difference. It was a place where I think we were experiencing a kind of isolation within isolation.
And how did that isolation register on you?
Well, I think I became a little more shy than I would have been otherwise. You know, it's always hard to be the new kid at school, and I had been doing it for so long. There were so many years where I was the new kid at school. But then to be not just the new kid, but also one of the only Black kids added this added layer of confusion and complexity. And I think it drew me inward in a way that I hadn't been drawn inward before.
I think it was in your op-ed piece a few years ago, yeah, that you wrote, at home, we weren't Black. At home, we were Ghanaian. What did that mean in your family?
Well, in my family, that meant that we continued to practice the kind of cultural touchstones of being Ghanaian. My family ate Ghanaian food. We attended, in Ohio at least, we attended the African Christian Church, which was half Ghanaian, half Nigerian. We did as much as we could to kind of keep the spirit of our home country alive. In fact, every place that we moved to, the first thing that my parents would do would be to grab the phone book, back when there were phone books, and look up Ghanaian last names in order to call the families and tell them that we had arrived. And I think they did that because it was really important to them to maintain community.
But they couldn't do that in Alabama?
In Alabama, they could to some extent. We had been connected with another Ghanaian family. And as I grew older, there were more and more Ghanaians, but there were far fewer in Alabama than there were in any of the other places that we lived in.
So was seeing themselves as Ghanaian and not as Black also a way of trying to remove themselves from racism in America, because the racism was, you know, directed at Black people, but they were Ghanaian?
I don't know if it was a conscious decision on their part. I think that they couldn't really think of themselves in any other way. I think having come from a country where everyone was the same race as them, race just wasn't a factor that they really valued or that they thought about too frequently. And I think in some ways it was their children who had to kind of lead the charge in helping them to understand how important race is here in America.
Your first novel, Homegoing, is about the family trees of two half-sisters from Ghana who were born in the 1700s. And you went to Ghana on a research scholarship when you were in college, and it was your first time back there since your family left Ghana when you were two. Did you feel connected to Ghana? Did it feel like going home to you in any way?
Well, I should say my family did go back altogether when I was 11, so it was my second time back in Ghana. And I think that because I was going that summer when I was a rising junior in college, I was going really for the purposes of researching a novel. I was able to kind of think about the place differently. I was kind of researching and searching. I think that allowed me to have my own connection to the country that stood kind of outside of my family.
Did writing Homegoing deepen the connection you felt to Ghana, since you did research there and you wrote about it?
Yes, absolutely. And that was really one of the aims in writing Homegoing. I was so desperately searching for a way to think about this place that I was from but didn't know. And obviously I was approaching it through fiction, and I was approaching it through research, so it's not as fully embodied as if I, you know, packed up and moved and tried to learn about it that way. But it was an exercise in discovery and an exercise in trying to build a sense of connection to Ghana.
One of the things you did in Ghana was visit a slave castle where people who were captured to be slaves were held and then shipped to, you know, Britain or the U.S. Would you describe the experience of being in that castle? Because it figures prominently into your first novel, Homegoing.
Yes, it was an incredibly formative experience. I went on the tour that they give to anyone who goes to visit the castle. And from the outside, the building is so beautiful. And then as you take the tour, you're seeing just the upper levels with these cannons that face out to the sea, this gorgeous view of the sea, you see the church. And then from there, they take you down to see the dungeons. Standing in the dungeons was one of the most harrowing experiences that I've ever had. Even after all of these years, that space still smells. It still has grime on the walls. I'm not a particularly superstitious person, but it is the only time in my life where I've felt like I was standing in a haunted place. You could feel the history that still lived in that place. And I knew immediately that I wanted to write about it in some capacity, particularly because the tour guide had just told us that there were free Gold Coast women walking up above. And I thought, how could you stand above this area, this dungeon, either not knowing or not fighting to free the people below? So it was the only time, I think, in my writing life that I've felt anything akin to a stroke of inspiration. I just felt so haunted by that place that I wanted to write about it.
Homegoing, your first novel, required you immersing yourself in the history of slavery and the history of the consequences, the still reverberating consequences of slavery. And I'm wondering what that experience was like for you, because, you know, you had to do a lot of research, but it was a very emotional form of research, including, you know, being in the dungeon of one of the slave-holding castles in Ghana. And, you know, you had to describe the experiences of people who were held in the dungeons, of people who became slaves. And you had to decide how graphic and how much suffering and torment and pain and physical brutality you had to write in these stories. So can you talk a little bit about what it was like to immerse yourself in the pain of this history and to figure out how to describe the actual suffering?
Sure. Well, I always say that researching the novel was so much more difficult than writing the novel, because at least as I was writing, I had the knowledge that the characters that I was creating weren't real. And yet when I read these research texts, I couldn't hide in that. For me, the fact of the matter is that for every painful thing that happens in Homegoing, there is an equally painful or far worse thing that happened to a real person. And so I wanted to honor that by writing the book in a way that didn't hide from the painful moments, that didn't try to kind of elide the painful moments, but also one that didn't kind of relish in the graphicness of some of these situations. And it was a fine balance to keep. But I think as long as I approached it as an opportunity, again, to kind of resurrect the lives of characters who might have gone through these situations and honor those lives in so doing, the writing felt in some ways as an act of love and justice.
You know, the title of your first novel is Homegoing, and I know a lot of African Americans use that expression to describe what happens after somebody dies, that it's a homegoing. Does that have its origin in African cultures?
No, the term, I think, began in America among the enslaved people who believed that once someone died, his or her spirit could return to the country from which they had been stolen. And so that's where the phrase homegoing came from. So it is an African-American term, but I liked it for the title of this book of homegoing because there was this kind of idea that no matter how far these characters ended up from those origin points, they could always return home.
In your novel, the main character, Gifty, thinks, I would always have something, because of racism, she thinks, I would always have something to prove, and nothing but blazing brilliance would be enough to prove it. I feel like through your novels, like, you've proved your brilliance, and I'm wondering if that's, like, still a motivating factor for you. You know, proving yourself to overcome racism and to disprove the thinking behind racism.
No, I don't think that that's a motivation for me because I don't think that racism is something that I need to overcome, that I can overcome. I think of racism as a problem that white people need to overcome, that they need to figure out what to do about it, how to approach their lives in a way that is better. So for me, I don't think that I'm thinking about combating racism when I write. I think what Gifty is saying there is a kind of reasserting of that idea that you have to be twice as good to get half as far. And I think that that often reveals itself to be a lie. There is no amount of goodness, there is no amount of blazing brilliance that will exempt you from racism, and therefore it is not on you to act in a way that will try to exempt yourself from racism, because racism is not about Black people.
Well, yeah, Jesse, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for your new novel, and I wish you good health and good luck with the book.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Jesse speaking with Terry Gross about her novel, Transcendent Kingdom. Lisa Donovan is a celebrated Southern pastry chef and a writer whose essays in the magazine Food and Wine have won the James Beard Award for food writing. Her first book, a memoir, has just been published. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Donovan has perfected her own signature recipe for memoir writing.
Here's a beaut of a sentence, one of many from Lisa Donovan's new memoir called Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger. If someone values you only when you're about to walk out the door, you should definitely keep walking. Donovan is a celebrated Southern pastry chef. Because I'm not a foodie, I didn't know that before I picked up her memoir, which is in the MFK Fisher, Ruth Reichel tradition of a woman making sense of her life through her passion for food, or in Donovan's case, specifically for baking. Along the way, Donovan, who was born into a mixed-race, working-class, military family, somehow summoned up the strength to walk out of a lot of doors. When she was barely out of high school, Donovan became pregnant by an abusive boyfriend. For the sake of her infant son, she caved to family pressure to give the relationship another try. Donovan moved in with her baby's father for a few months, was beaten and raped by him, and just managed to escape with her son to her parents' house. A few years later, Donovan landed a job teaching art at a conservative private girls' school in Nashville. As an unwed single mother, Donovan was lectured by the school's headmaster about what a bad influence she'd be on the girls. She also found out during the school year that she was vastly underpaid compared to comparable male teachers. Before she walked out that door, Donovan took her art class, full of girls blinkered by family wealth, on a field trip to the faculty parking lot, where she showed her students the used and dented cars of their teachers as Exhibit A of how the other 95% of people in the world lives. And most publicly, Donovan walked out the door of Husk, a restaurant founded by celebrity Southern chef Sean Brock, because she found the atmosphere of that kitchen so toxic and sexist. Even though Donovan was receiving acclaim for her work as de facto executive pastry chef, when she asked for the official title and the raise that went with it, she was told she'd have to essentially fire one of the female pastry chefs working under her to get the money. Here's another beaut of a sentence from Donovan, in fact, a couple of them, that hone in on the danger to women, particularly in the food industry, of contenting themselves with gratitude and praise from men for their work in lieu of professional recognition. Women are revered straight into abjection, useful only as a totem of inspiration. When we go to make work our own, we are unable to survive in the industry the men build, the one they sell our wares within. I'm making Lisa Donovan sound like a natural-born badass, always self-possessed enough to know when it's time to fight or take flight. But that's not how she comes off in this memoir, which chronicles her hard-won, decades-long, two steps forward and one step back, messy process of coming to own her worth. Donovan also began to see the legions of women who never got credit for their culinary inventions and skill, among them her own Mexican and Appalachian ancestors, as well as the enslaved people and domestic workers whose traditions formed the foundation of Southern cooking. Donovan is such a vivid writer, smart, raunchy, vulnerable, and funny, that if her vaunted caramel cakes and sugar pies are half as good as her prose, well, I'd be open to even giving that signature buttermilk whipped cream she tops her desserts with a try. There's a fabulous scene early on where Donovan recalls fighting to walk through a door this time. It's the door of a college classroom where a sculpture class is about to begin. The young professor, who by the way will become Donovan's husband, doesn't want to let her in because the students will be doing welding and Donovan is toting along her nursing infant son. As the professor becomes more of an obstacle, Donovan gets angrier, fantasizing about educating this guy about what it's like to have certain female body parts welded together again after squeezing out a 9-pound baby. Unfortunately, that's as specific as I can be about the robust and salty language that infuses this entire memoir. Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger is about the multiple hungers that Donovan has been driven to satisfy in her life, for wonderful food, certainly, but also for love and community and for gratifying work that can support a family. It's not too much to hope for, is it? But as Donovan chronicles, it can take women a while to muster up the self-respect to know they can do more than just hope.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Our Lady of Perpetual Hunger by Lisa Donovan. In the 2012 film Zero Dark Thirty, about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, there's a scene where a suspected terrorist is being waterboarded by an American interrogator who's demanding information.
Where was the last time you saw bin Laden? Where was the last time you saw bin Laden, huh?
You know, when you lie to me, I hurt you.
It's cool that you're strong. I respect it. I do. But in the end, everybody breaks, bro. It's biology.
There's a widespread belief that harsh, so-called enhanced interrogation techniques like sleep deprivation and waterboarding, however distasteful, yielded valuable information in the battle against terrorism. Our guest, former FBI agent Ali Soufan, says the record of investigations into terrorist networks shows exactly the opposite is true. Soufan, born in Lebanon and fluent in Arabic, has interrogated dozens of al-Qaeda members and other extremists. He says interrogations based on careful preparation and building rapport generated useful information and actionable intelligence from detainees, while torture usually induced subjects to clam up or give bad information to make the torment stop. Soufan published a book about his experiences in 2011 after vetting it with the FBI, but the CIA succeeded in redacting large portions of it. Now, after a legal battle, the redactions have been restored, and the book, Black Banners Declassified, How Torture Derailed the War on Terror After 9/11, is available. Ali Soufan served in the FBI from 1997 to 2005. He's also the author of the 2017 book, The Anatomy of Terror. He now heads the Soufan Group, a private intelligence and security consulting firm. He spoke to me from his home in northern New Jersey. Ali Soufan, welcome back to Fresh Air. You know, we heard at the end of that clip from Zero Dark 30, the interrogator saying, you know, in the end, everybody breaks, you know, it's biology. And, you know, we've seen this in TV and movies for years. You know, cops slap around suspects. You know, criminals beat information out of informants. There's a general feeling that, yeah, pain makes people tell the truth. Before you got into the FBI, did you think that was true too?
Well, this is a Hollywood version of reality. I can tell you, and what I talk about in this book is the reality itself. So, look, torture give you compliance. I don't want compliance. I want cooperation. I don't want people to tell me what I want to hear. I don't want people to lie to me. I want them to tell me the truth. You don't get that in torture. You get it in building rapport and traditional interrogation technique that outsmart the detainee into cooperation. There's a big difference between cooperation and compliance.
You write that you often knew a lot more about the Quran than the al-Qaeda members that you interrogated. And of course, you were fluent in Arabic, which made a big difference. You didn't have to wait for translation. And, you know, it's also clear as you describe these interrogations that understanding social traditions made a difference. And one thing that caught my eye was there were many cases where you said that al-Qaeda subjects hated to be caught lying, even about something trivial. They would tell a story, and then because you were well prepared, you would say, no, that's not what happened. What struck me about your description of those interrogations was that you would say that the subject would be embarrassed when you would catch them lying.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, you'd say, yeah, no, that's not right. They do it again. No, that's not right. And then you ask something that you actually don't know the answer to, but now they don't want to be embarrassed themselves again. It's really remarkable to me that avoiding embarrassment would be a motivator when this is really high-stakes information they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's first of all, it's a cultural issue. Second, they claim that they are religious pious and lying is forbidden. And when you catch them with that, you're just showing them that they are hypocrites. So that helps. But you cannot just bluff yourself out of interrogation if you don't have knowledge, if you don't have the facts on your side. And I tell them, look, there's a lot of things I know. There's a lot of things I don't know. There are some stuff I am not sure about, but I'm not going to tell you what I know, what I'm not sure about, and what I don't know, because that's how I know if you're saying the truth or not. And I think I said that to many of the suspected terrorists that I interrogated over the years.
One of the more high-value subjects that you interviewed was Abu Zubaydah, and he was captured, I guess, about a year after the 9/11 attacks, right, in a shootout in which he was quite seriously injured, and you and another interrogator had to talk to him, and he was near death. What was it like trying to talk to him when he it was so serious? He'd been shot. You took him to the hospital at one point. It wasn't clear he was going to survive.
I looked at Abu Zubaydah. He was at a gurney, and I said to him, "What's your name?" He responded, "Dawood," meaning David in Arabic. I said, "What if I call you Hani?" And he has this big shock on his face, you know, and he shook his head. Okay. Later, the CIA and the FBI colleagues who were with me said, "What did you tell him?" Because the conversation was in Arabic, so I told them what happened, and they said, "So why did the name scare him?" I said, "Because that is the name his mother used to call him as a child." So he kind of knew that we know everything about him. So immediately at this moment, and he just finished a surgery and brought to the location where we were, I basically, you know, asked him, so why do you think we finally caught you? I know he's very smart. I know that he is trying to analyze the situation, what kind of mistakes happened in his own security that led him to be captured. And I said, any phone calls you did later on, any plot you're working on? And he basically thought that we already knew about a plot that he was working on in a third country, allied country. And he gave us information regarding that plot, thinking that probably we disrupted it through communication surveillance or something like this. So we wrote that. It went to the White House and Langley. I think the DCI at the time, George Tenet, from what we were told, was very happy with the information, how fast the information was coming. And later on that evening, a few hours later, Abu Zubaydah became septic. So we had to basically get permission to take him to a hospital and give him good medical treatment. And I recall the answer came from Langley at the time, that death is not an option. He's cooperating, he's giving information. We need to keep him healthy. So that's what we did. We took him to a hospital. The interviews basically stopped a little bit while he was in medical treatment. And then later on, he continued to cooperate with us. He continued to give us very good actionable intelligence that disrupted plots. And actually, during that time period, he identified Khalid Sheikh Mohammed as the mastermind of 9/11.
It was remarkable information to get from a guy who was seriously injured. There was a point where, if I read this right, you actually had to clean him up when he had soiled himself. I mean, it was a pretty crude set of circumstances you were in, right?
Yeah, this is before we took him to the hospital. So we really took care of him. And that actually, helped us create a bond in a way, if you want to call it a bond. So, for example, the way we identified Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has nothing to do with torture, has nothing to do with waterboarding. What happened is he was telling me about a plot against one of our bases. And the person who was in charge of this plot is now the number two guy in Al-Qaeda. And I wanted to show him his photo to just be sure that this is an individual. And the plot was disrupted. So my colleague had, do you recall those Palm Pilots, the old devices? So we didn't have a photo book with us, but we downloaded a poster that was put by the FBI of all the jihadi terrorists. And that guy was wanted for the East Africa embassy bombing. So I showed him the photo and I said, is this the guy? And basically Abu Zubaydah said no. And I was really angry. I said, look, after everything we did for you, after cleaning you up, and you still lie to us. You think I don't know this guy? Abu Zubaydah was very frustrated. And he said to me, hey, brother, don't play these games with me. This is Mukhtar. This is the guy who did 9/11. And I looked at the photo, and it was the photo of KSM. At the time, we had no idea that KSM was a member of Al-Qaeda. And definitely, we didn't know he was the mastermind of 9/11.
So you managed to get this really valuable information from him through building rapport. And you tell a story here about what happened when the CIA got the memoranda that you submitted about all this information, and they said, great, congratulate our CIA agents on what a great job they've done. Then they realized that it wasn't their people, it was you two FBI agents. What happened then with the interrogation?
Well, when that happened, they basically, what I was told, that Director Tenet was basically hitting the table and say, why CTC is not there? I want them to be there.
CTC is his people, the Counterterrorism Center, right?
The Counterterrorism Center. And they came almost 10 days after we got Abu Zubaydah. And they had a different plan. They had a contractor with them. The contractor's idea of interrogation is very different than what we were doing. His idea is to have one person deal with Abu Zubaydah. that person has, Abu Zubaydah has to see that person as his own god. So he basically determined if he live or die, if he's comfortable or not. And we were, you know, shocked with all these things. It was like, that never happened before. We know what's going on. Are you familiar with Islamic extremists? Are you familiar with Al-Qaeda? He said, I don't have to be familiar with any of these things. I'm familiar with the human nature. So we had to give Abu Zubaydah to the person who's going to supposed to be his god. And we were told that we will never see Abu Zubaydah again. A couple of days later, they had to bring us back in because all the information have been stopped. And people in the U.S. government were asking, what happened? Why all of a sudden no information is being transmitted? So they brought us back in.
Well, that's because they had in fact, you know, begun sleep deprivation and forced nudity things, right? And he refused to cooperate anymore.
And he refused to cooperate. He was confused about what's going on, because what happened is they come in and they say, tell me what I want to know. And he said, what do you want to know? And then the person walked out of the room. So it's kind of like, this is not how interrogations work. That was some sort of experimentation that actually stopped the flow of information. And these facts that he didn't cooperate and they had to bring us back was redacted. And actually, by redacting it, they unintentionally helped the truth, because you don't redact lies on national security grounds. What you redact is facts. And now the people can read the facts about the alleged efficacy of torture, of enhanced interrogation techniques, and how we actually get information that President Bush, Cheney, and a lot of other people claimed we get because of EITs.
Right. And we should say that Abu Zubaydah eventually was taken to a different location and was waterboarded how many times?
Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times. And with the 83 times, they did not get any information from him that we didn't get earlier. Actually, they got some lies. For example, he admitted that he is the number three in Al-Qaeda, even though we knew from day one that Abu Zubaydah was not a member of Al-Qaeda. He worked closely with Al-Qaeda. He worked with Osama bin Laden. But he's not a number three of the organization. He's not even a member of the organization. So they get stuff from him that they wanted to hear. But these things were not facts. And that is the dangerous element of torture.
Right. Now, so you got this valuable information by building rapport with him. The torture got bad information and no information. But when this was described in internal memoranda and eventually by government officials, right, when they talked about enhanced interrogation, what was the story they told?
The story was, we had to do enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding because Abu Zubaydah stopped cooperating. And that is not true. Abu Zubaydah was cooperating when they implemented all these things. And today, with the black banners declassified, you can see all the stories. You can see, for example, how the plot of Jose Padilla, the so-called dirty bomber, was disrupted, or the Brooklyn Bridge so-called plot, or the WMD program for Al-Qaeda. You will see all these kind of things and how we were able to get them and how we were able to disrupt them. And let me tell you, all these things happened month and month before enhanced interrogation techniques started, before waterboarding started.
I'm interested in your feelings about some of these detainees that you have spoken to, because you clearly got to know many of them well. You knew their stories. You built rapport. You made connections. I'm just wondering what the feelings that you felt. It must have been conflicted, because you're seeing these people who in many cases were young people who maybe not that sophisticated, had gotten lured into committing themselves to an extremist ideology. And, you know, I can imagine feeling some sympathy. On the other hand, I mean, these are people who supported and in some cases participated in acts of just incredible savagery, you know, killing hundreds of innocent people. How did you reconcile those feelings?
You know what? I think you have to check your emotions at the door when you're dealing with these kind of things. I never doubted in a second that most of these people that I interrogated, if the situation was different, they will behead me. They will kill me. Actually, Abu Zubaydah told me that. I said, now we build a rapport. We're friends. We're talking to each other. What happens if you catch us? He said, I'll behead you immediately. He didn't even question it. You know, I don't have sympathy for these terrorists. They, as you mentioned, they killed, some of them were responsible for the death of hundreds, if not thousands of people when it comes to 9/11. But I oppose torture because it does not work. I oppose torture because it shows that it did not help to make us safe. It actually helped our enemies. And it helps Al-Qaeda to recruit. You know, images of Abu Ghraib was very important in creating what we've seen in Iraq later on. And I think transparency is extremely important because I believe democracy depends on lively exchange of opinion. But we need to have a mutual understanding of truth. And what we're witnessing today, this fact-free culture, is, you know, merely taken its own logical conclusion today. The truth has been swamped for many years by conspiracy theories, by emotions, by partisan talking points, by alternative facts. And because of that, today opinions enjoys the same status as reality, as the truth. And no wonder why our enemies find it easy to divide us with disinformation campaigns. Because, you know, our government, people in our government, started dividing us with this way before the Russians or the Chinese or the Iranians or whoever, you know, is doing it today.
Well, Ali Soufan, stay safe, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ali Soufan served in the FBI from 1997 to 2005. His book is The Black Banners Declassified: How Torture Derailed the War on Terror After 9/11.